Hey, welcome to Faithfully Memphis. My name is Emily Austin. I'm with the Episcopal Church in West Tennessee. We are broadcast each Thursday morning on WYXR 91.7 FM here in Memphis from their Crosstown Concourse studios. Or maybe you're joining us from the Faithfully Memphis podcast. If you are, thank you. Will you do me a big favor and go on to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, but preferably Apple Podcasts, and leave us a review. Tell us what you're thinking of the show. That really helps us to get the word out about Faithfully Memphis and hopefully help us fall in front of the ears of people who might want to hear what we have to say. Each week on our show, we engage in interesting conversations with inspiring, interesting people about spirituality, the role that their faith plays in their life. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you're realizing, hopefully, that we like to go to the margins. We like to listen and hear from people whose spirituality and the role that God plays in their life may not be what you expect. And this week is no different than that. Actually, several weeks ago, I had the opportunity to hop on a Zoom call with somebody who I have admired from afar for quite some time. Her name is Shannon K. Evans. She is a woman with a Catholic spirituality and an interfaith heart, and her titles include Embracing Weakness, Luminous, Rewilding Motherhood, and most recently, a book that we're going to talk a lot about called Feminist Prayers for My Daughter. Shannon is the spirituality and culture editor for the National Catholic Reporter, and she also writes and leads retreats for the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the U.S. And boy howdy, guys, I really am looking forward to you hearing my conversation with her because she breaks the mold in a lot of different ways and but also is just really relatable. So I'm really excited for you to hear that. But first, let's talk about the saint of the day. Now, I think that sometimes when we open up this segment called Saint of the Day, I have this desire to unpack it a little bit. Where are these names coming from? Who are these people that we're talking about? Well, they are usually from the church calendar of lesser feasts and fasts. This is something that a lot of churches have, the Catholic Church certainly, but our Episcopal Church as well. And these are people who almost take on an otherworldly status, right? And with that in mind, I want to tell you about our saint of the day. Her name is Zita of Tuscany. And while I tell you about her, ask that you think about what about her story and what about the things that we've passed down around this woman. How much are they communal and how much are they things that were specific to her? Because that's something that I've been thinking a lot about. But I'll go ahead and tell you a little bit about her and then we'll talk a little bit about who she was and who she could have been and how we revere her now. So Zita of Tuscany was born in the year 1271 in the village of, okay, buckle up because I'm going to try to pronounce it correctly, Monte Sagrati in Tuscany. She was born into a poor family, but one in which the Christian faith was emphasized. And side note, I can't imagine in the year 1271, that wasn't what the expectation was, right? That's just my comment on that. One of her uncles was a hermit, and one of her sisters became a nun, and the entire family was faithful in worship together, both at church and in their home. And at the age of 12, Zita entered the service of the Fatinelli family in Lucca. And although little more than a child, she maintained the serious faith that she had been taught by her family. Scrupulous in the exercise of her domestic duties, she embodied Paul's advice to the Colossians, whatever your task, put yourself into it. Her earnest diligence, however, was met with scorn from both her employers and her fellow servants. Evidently, the headmistress of this household was an older woman and was probably just really jealous. Didn't like it that this young woman, not young woman, child, was really, really savoring her work and made her life pretty miserable. Nevertheless, Zita continued faithfully in her work and exhibited a peace that surpassed comprehension. And through her perseverance in doing good, she eventually earned the respect and affection of the whole household. And in due course, the once despised servant became the housekeeper. As head of the household staff, Zita demonstrated such Christ-like benevolence that she came to be venerated through Luca even before her death. And mindful of the poverty in which she had been raised, she gave away most of her income to those in need. And a couple other sources that I looked at describe how she gave 1/3 of her wages to her family, and she kept 1/3, and she gave the rest to the poor. And as a result, the mistress of the house placed Zita in charge of the household almsgiving, which was the charity that the household would have given to the people in need. And they allowed her to visit the sick poor in their own homes and tend to their needs. So in a way, this is again me talking, I think it's interesting that Zita was seen as an extension of this family's generosity. Just something to think on. A small room isolated from the rest of the house was put at Zita's disposal, and she would venture out in the evenings and invite some poor homeless women to supper. The room had a bed and was offered a safe shelter for the night, and she always rose several hours before the rest of the family and took care to hear Mass every morning before she began her work. She attended to her tasks with diligence and fidelity and studied when possible to anticipate what needed to be done. So one of the stories that has come to be associated with her in and is depicted in artwork of Zita is her carrying bread in her cloak to bring to the poor. Jealous servants reported this to the master, who confronted Zita, and upon opening the cloak, it was found to be full of flowers. And apparently there's a similar story told about another venerated woman from the church, Elizabeth of Hungary. There's another anecdote that relates a story of Zita giving away her own food during a famine and then that of her master. And when she remonstrated with her for depleting the family's own resources, they found the pantry fully stocked. It's because of these miracles that later on, when her canonization, it would have been 1580 or so, these were the miracles that earned her canonization and recognition as a saint. You know, Zita and so many other women who have been canonized and who we are instructed to look toward for our own inspiration and to see as, you know, among the throng of witnesses, that great cloud of witnesses. Lately, when I've thought about their lives and thought about who they are and who they were, I often wonder what they would say today if they knew that we were thinking about them and asking them to intercede for us and modeling our own lives after them. It's definitely something that is more modern, where we look inward to ourselves and say, how would I respond to a certain prompt? So maybe they would say, why would you ask me what I think of you thinking of me? Maybe it's completely ridiculous, but I think about Zita, this woman who we only know about her in her relationship to others, and how she gave to the poor and ministered to the poor and served a household through her entire life. There's no mention of her relationships and anything like a marriage or children or friendships. We only know for what she gave of herself to those around her. And I wonder what she would say. I wonder if these miracles that she performed, these things that she did that brought balm to people around her, I wonder what motivated it. Maybe she would say God, maybe whatever her explanation for the piety that she lived with in life. I would love to know how she was feeling and how she felt about the people who were in that household and were making her life miserable because she was there to do her job. She was 12 years old. I mean, and then she wasn't 12 years old forever, but you know, there wasn't a lot of mobility. I wonder what she would have chosen for herself. Would she have gone back if given a choice and lived the life that she led? What would she say about the things that we say about her today? In an even larger way, how much of the story of this woman of faith is a story, and how much of it is the reality? Maybe that's something that we could ask of ourselves. Perhaps the things that matter are bringing comfort and peace and food to those who are hurting, and standing up and doing the right thing and being recognized or not recognized for doing the right thing and for caring for someone who needs care. Maybe that's the thing that matters. I'll be right back with Shannon K. Evans. Hey, this is Emily Austin for the Episcopal Church in West Tennessee, and you're tuning into Faithfully Memphis, and I'm really, really, really excited to have on today. I mean, and I said really a bunch of times because this is big. I'm delighted to have on Shannon K. Evans, who I have known about for a few years because we have a very strong mutual connection in Cameron Belm, who was on Faithfully Memphis near the very beginning. And I'll make sure that I think that we weren't even posting those episodes up as a podcast yet, but I'm going to see if I can find that and put it on the podcast, her conversation with Bishop Phoebe. But Shannon K. Evans' new book, Feminist Prayers for My Daughter, you need it. Hey, Shannon, how are you?
Hi, great intro. I love it.
I mean, the energy is here.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me and being patient as I recovered from medical stuff to be able to get on.
Yeah, you know, when it rains, it pours.
Yes, it does.
When you're about to publish a book and it's Lent and you're getting ready for Easter, that's usually when you have major medical crises, right?
You know what? I went into the hospital on Ash Wednesday.
You didn't have to give up anything for Lent.
Yeah, right. I was like, this is it. This is a week in the hospital and, you know, 6 weeks of recovery. And I was like, actually had some like embodied anxiety during Holy Week as Easter crept up. Cause I was like, okay, like this started on Ash Wednesday. Is something going to happen on Easter Sunday? You know, but
that would be way too poetic.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got the writer's brain. It's like, there's always a metaphor somewhere.
Oh yeah. I'm not a writer of fiction, but I think that the way that I tend to romanticize stuff like that is something that I'm a victim to as well. Yeah. Okay. So just tell me the story of you and what kind of tradition were you raised in? How did that get to where you are as a Catholic writer in the Jesuit tradition who is bold, and a Catholic writer who is just came out with a book called Feminist Prayers?
and I've read this book, I'm reading it, I'm praying with it, and it'll pierce your heart in the best way. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, buckle up, Emily. It's a long story.
I love it.
I was raised Baptist, but not Southern Baptist. So not necessarily, I don't think my parents would consider themselves evangelical, but there was definitely evangelical flavor in my upbringing to an extent. And my dad is actually a theologian. So he has a degree from a couple of different places, one of them being Yale. So he's kind of a big wig in the Baptist world. And he was a pastor when I was a kid. And then when I was 8, he started teaching in the religion department at Baylor University. So we moved to Texas. And my parents are very, very mindful of like the social gospel, if you will, and the way that Jesus kind of requires things of us, you know, in our communities and in our worldviews. And so they did a really great job of instilling that value of caring for the marginalized and prioritizing the poor. And I think that's one of the greatest gifts that they gave me.
Yeah.
And then, but I will say, like, I went to church because that's what we did.
Yeah, you know, that's what you do.
Never necessarily very internalized for me. And then I went kind of, I don't know what you would say. And now I see that it's very healthy, but at the time it was very like prodigal daughter, like, she's partying. What are we going to do? Like, she's not safe. And so there was like a few years of really pushing boundaries and crisis.
Yeah.
And when I came out of that, I started going to a charismatic evangelical church.
Ah.
And I got very, very invested in that community. I made friends, girlfriends for the first time in a long time and that felt really good and really warm and safe. And there was so much about that being in a community that met a real need in me. And so I stayed, even though I think in my intuition, in my gut, there were a lot of things that didn't sit right with me that were being taught and pushed. And my parents were a little bit uncomfortable with some of the stuff too, but they were also just very happy that I was doing better.
You know,
I seemed really interested in this whole Jesus thing finally.
Yeah. And, I think that's something as mothers that, you know, you sometimes when I see my own kid going through chapters where things are not great all the time, and then she finds something that probably I would not choose for her, or I would not choose for myself either, but it's healthy and it's making her happy. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Hands off. Good. Okay, good on you. Good on you.
Yeah. Again, I have a lot of respect. They certainly expressed when they had concerns or raised questions, but for the most part, I just felt like they handled that really well. This particular church community had a missions organization, and they sent out missionaries all over the world to supposedly plant churches, but we never planted a church. Yeah, I was a missionary for 2 years.
Yeah.
And that was, I married my spouse, Eric, and then we went together for 2 years to Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I think I really had to face the fact that, like, I was really giving my life to something that I wasn't sure I believed, which was kind of the getting people from one side of the line to the other so that they're saved and they don't go to hell, and you know, and even just meeting these very, very devout Muslim people who embodied the gospel in really beautiful ways, and I was like, I don't feel like they need me.
It's kind of like, who's saving who in this situation?
Yes, it's
who do we need, you know, air quotes, saving?
When
we're actually the ones doing the learning by listening.
You know, and there's so much of that I wish, and I want to still, but like, I wish I had really been able to experience Indonesia for who she is as a people and as a country, as a like environment and ecosystem without having this burden of, I mean, it really was, I went into depression because it just felt like such a burden that I couldn't just enjoy people. It was like I had a responsibility, I had a mission to fulfill, and I always felt like I was failing because I didn't want to actually do it.
Yeah.
So there was a lot there. And so then we decided to come home a year early. We had committed to 3 years and we came mm-hmm. home a year early.
And you were just doing like full on mission work, right?
Well, we were in, our visa was for language. So we were learning, we were in language school, but yes, we were part of a team that had been there a while and had like different initiatives going.
Yeah. It wasn't like the couple goes to Asia to teach English or whatever. No. I mean, it was, you were there at, with a church sponsorship.
Yeah. And when we actually, while we were there, decided, because this is totally Shannon Evans, that I decided that we decided, but I really pushed it, that we should adopt our first child instead of trying to have one biologically. And it did involve a lot of prayer, but it also was a lot of my white savior complex of like, this is what I'm going to do. But we weren't able to adopt there or any country in Southeast Asia for various reasons. And at the time, the program in Uganda was quite easy and accessible. And so that was the direction that we went. So when we came home from Indonesia, we adopted our son in Uganda and then came home. And long story short, the introduction of trauma and into our lives and actual suffering that we had never really experienced before. He was only one, but there was a lot there.
Yeah.
That basically just blew up our theology. And it was like, we need something that addresses suffering. We need something that feels authentic to who we are.
Yeah.
We started going to this Anglican church. And then when we moved, we got involved with a Catholic worker. And that kind of sealed the deal. Worker is Dorothy Days that she started. And we just kind of fell in love with the social teaching and seeing people live that out was really moving, especially coming from a paradigm that approached marginalized people much differently.
Yes.
To come in and for it to be about reciprocity and solidarity in a time that we were really suffering and needed support, just like, that was it. we're Catholic.
Definitely check out the episode of Faithfully Memphis that we did with Tracy Burgess, who is the ED of the Dorothy Day House here in Memphis. Miranda Cully, who's the priest at St. Mary's Episcopal School, interviewed her. So sidebar, listen to that episode.
At the same time, I think we, because our family was suffering, I think there was really an appeal.
You needed something.
Yes. There was like the way that Catholicism like kind of had an answer for everything. There felt like a lot of certainty there.
Yeah.
And that felt very comforting and safe. And I think that was really healthy at the time. And in the years since, which it's been about 10 years now, that has become less important to me. And I'm more interested in the gray space and the mystery. But yeah, there's a time for everything.
You know, I really identify a lot with your story and just the way that you've walked through that, because I grew up in a not dissimilar tradition than, you know, the Baptist faith that you were raised with. I grew up with a tradition where we didn't have a prayer book, and we didn't have, there wasn't such an enshrinement of rituals and the liturgy. And I feel like that was one of the first things that when I was carving out and I was searching for my own kind of Christian identity and finding who my Christ is. Who is Christ to me? That was something about the Anglican and the Episcopal iteration of that that really it is still precious to me.
Yeah,
that there's, for times of difficulty, it's not that the church can fix everything and has an answer to anything. I mean, I would never claim that, but I think that there's such a peace in the liturgy and the tradition of the way that we pray. And I feel like there's a little bit more of a language that I identify with in working through really hard things, like it sounds like y'all were going through when you adopted this child whose challenges were so outside of the realm of understanding. There's something about a liturgical tradition that it won't answer everything, but it can really be a balm when you're going through things that you've never been through before, and challenges and hard things that will blow your mind.
Yeah, I agree. Like, when we started going to the Anglican church early on, it was Eric really wanted to try it. He'd always been drawn to liturgical traditions. And I was sort of like, kind of like, you know, still in the evangelical space of like, oh, I don't like,
yeah,
liturgy, written prayers, like, does, is that
standing up and sitting down? Yeah. And
like somebody telling you when to do what. But yes, what I found and what I still find true is that there's something so comforting and safe about not having to reinvent the wheel.
Yes.
And to know that for centuries, people have been doing these same rituals, and it just anchors you to the Christian tradition in general, but also it's very anchoring in like the sense of safety and the sense of just comfort of like having a form to return to when things feel chaotic and when things feel really hard. I know when we were in the Catholic worker community in Texas, we pray night prayer at our house. People would come, and for a while it was sort of, the community was sort of operated out of our living room.
Yeah.
And so we would do night prayer, and it was just what my soul needed, you know, to give words to some of the fears and the sorrows, and just ending the day in community, acknowledging all of that spaciousness together that can feel scary. It's really beautiful.
I feel like that's a perfect seg into the writer piece and how your spiritual writing and especially this book of prayers came about. I mean, have you always been a writer? Has this been something that you've carried with you for your whole life? Because I feel like sometimes it usually is.
Yeah, it is. It's true. But it's very interesting. It moves in accordance with my spiritual journey. Yeah. So when I was young, I wrote constantly, just, you know, poems. I would write my own like magazine articles about like celebrities.
Oh, you and Cameron and I, you're like part of our posse. You would have fit in well with us when we were like 15 years old.
Yes. And then when I got older and kind of went through those years of trying to find myself and some depression and just heartbreak, I wrote a lot of poetry then.
Yeah.
And then when I quote unquote found Jesus, I stopped writing for years. And I remember at some point kind of being like, well, I guess I just, you know, I guess I'm healed. And that was what I needed to cope.
Oh yeah. Cause everyone knows that a conversion experience is a one and done deal.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Like, well, now I don't
it's taken care of. Yeah. We paid the house off. We're good.
Yeah. We paid the house off. Yeah. But it grieves me so much too, to look back, because I was like, that is so clearly a sign of me like losing myself and kind of rejecting a part of myself to fit this form, you know, to like, it just feels like one, I don't think I realized that was a way that I prayed.
Yeah.
And then to have lost that for so long feels really representative of kind of what happened to me during that time. And then being able to come back to myself and say, it was when I became a mom, when we adopted our son, that I started writing again. I started writing a blog about the journey. And I just remembered how, I can't even say how much I love it, just like how much it is a part of me and how it's how I process the world. And so then from then on, it was just over, but it was like, it was really interesting because it wasn't till a few years ago that I could look back and say, oh, that's actually also when I started returning to my own beliefs about God and my own spiritual practices and not what other people were telling me to do or think or believe. So yeah, writing has definitely been a deep part of who I am and my spirituality.
Yeah. I feel like writing through parenthood is extremely cathartic. And it helps us tease out meaning for sure. So what does your prayer practice look like now? I feel like the older I get, And my, and me as a person is inextricably tied up into my parenthood. And I have a hard time differentiating those different pieces of my life. It's all just one big glob of Emily, but I feel like parenting is a prayer in a way, and writing a prayer is the prayer. If that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah.
So what is, how does that look in your life now with not just one child and as someone, is it a big mash all the time?
It's a big mash a lot of the time. Yeah. No, but I agree with you. I think that there's so much of parenting that is prayer in that it's an opportunity for communion in the present, right? Like,
yeah.
And B, it's an opportunity to constantly be transformed, to kind of be undergoing that constant conversion that we're called to. Because it's just like, I mean, if prayer isn't changing us, then like, what is it doing? You know, like, what is prayer if it's not being changed?
Yeah.
And man, there's nothing that changes you quicker than being a parent and being thrown into that every day. And like, I don't always do it well. And I certainly wouldn't say like, you know, every moment is just this flowery prayer and it's lovely. But when I look back over like my parenting journey, it's like, oh, nothing, hands down, nothing has been more spiritually transformative for me. I have had spiritual growth in no greater way than being a mom. You know, I think lately in the past couple of years, my prayer practice has really shifted to what I finally identified as taking stuff away rather than adding things on.
Yeah.
And in the past, it was like the add-ons were like the checklist, read your Bible, have your list of, you know, prayer requests that you're going through, like maybe have a devotional book, like have a set time when you're doing it. And so
it's like, you need a whiteboard for your prayer life. It's like, maybe some people do. And maybe some people find that important, but
And I think there are seasons for it. Right. And I think maybe when I was younger and I needed more structure and discipline because I hadn't yet learned how to trust that still small voice inside of me. I think that that was helpful, but now it's like, now I'm trying to subtract rather than add. So like just being, you know, I happen to have the privilege of like living by woods and a prairie. And so just being out there with nothing and no agenda, but just learning presence and listening, like listening to whatever the divine wants to reveal, you know, and, or even just be like the gift of just doing nothing and being in God's presence, you know? So that's
and listening to what, and listening to what the divine is trying to say to you, because I think so often we place pressure on ourselves to come to the table with, okay, here are the things I'm supposed to say. Here are the, here are the things I'm supposed to pray about.
Right.
Here are the things that God is making sure that I'm bringing to them. When God has given us prayer as a gift, it's God who is communing with us, creating a space for that stillness. I mean, it's something I struggle with a lot because I have a very, my brain is going all the time. And there's a lot going on in there and a lot of dissonant sounds. God doesn't necessarily want that all the time.
Yeah. And you know, it can, I mean, especially in our age, like I feel like a granny saying this, but like there are just so many distractions now that it's just, it's hard to be still and like do quote unquote nothing in God's presence for more than 10 minutes. Cause most of us look at our phone like multiple times within 10 minutes. Like there's been research studies, you know? So even just the practice of leaving the phone in the house and going outside, like I can feel myself like,
it's like
Well, it's a mixture of the, and then it's a mixture of, like, my hand is like twitching, you know, not really, but you know what I mean?
Like, I know. No, I mean, my hand literally does twitch. Like, I'll pat my pockets and be like, I left my arm at home.
Right.
Whoops.
Yeah. Last weekend on Holy Saturday, I wanted to do something kind of special with Eric, and I got us appointments at a float tank. Have you ever done this or heard of it?
I've heard of it. I have not done it.
Well, I think people do it for different reasons, but it's basically like this small tank that you like pay money to go in. And it's like, it has so much salt in the water that you float. Like every human being, every body shape and size, it will be effective. You float and it's like warmish room temperature, but it's not like super warm. And it's dark, but you can get out. And it's just, I had my own, Eric had his own in a separate room, and you're in there for an hour. And man, it was so, so meditative, because there's literally nothing, there's no distraction, there's no temptation to grab your phone or to get up and do the laundry or anything. And it's not practical for me to do like once a week, because it's not in my town. It's like in the next town over, and for various reasons financially, but it was such a good experience for me to see like what it actually feels like to remove distractions and what it for an extended period of time. And it kind of created more of a resolve in me to do that more, to kind of create those spaces in my life. And whatever,
it's the kind of thing where we always say we need to be doing these types of things, and we rarely do them. Like we always say, oh, I should run more, or I should do X, Y, and Z, or whatever, self-care type things. And then when we finally gather the resolve to do them, it's like, oh, right, that was a good thing.
Yeah. That's true.
Well, okay. So feminist prayers for my daughter, I have had my copy for about a month now, and I have a daughter, and she's getting to the age where she's taking her own spirituality. I mean, maybe I was about to say she's taking her own spirituality more seriously. I don't know that she is taking it more or less seriously, but she's more, she wants to talk about it. Mm-hmm. She's more intuitive and asking me questions. Yeah. And as I'm parenting her through that, this book has been a real, just the way you articulate things, our hearts are very much in the same space. I'm praying with the book and with you for my daughter, but certainly praying for basically anybody who's a marginalized gender. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of book where we see ourselves as holy, because that's how God sees us. Yeah. Were these prayers that you had foaming up in you, and then you finally said, I have to write them down and share them? Like, how did this come about? And then, side note, maybe the bigger question is, you're coming from a Catholic tradition. You write for a Catholic press. And even within like my mainline church that officially claims feminism as an institution, and there's so much that there can be a lot of pushback. Mm-hmm. And so you were writing these prayers, you were thinking about these prayers, and then you get this book published. I mean, how has that all been?
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite a word salad, quite a hamburger of a question.
Yeah. You know, I expected more noise than I got, which I don't know. I feel like maybe at this point, like all of the negative conversations around me are happening in circles that I'm not even aware of right now. You know, like I'm so far removed from that like uber conservative circle. So I'm sure it is still happening, but I've been surprised that it's not like intruding on my life. And I think, you know, a few years ago, I was really struggling with whether to stay in the Catholic Church for a lot of that reason of just feeling really kind of pushed out, or that like my beliefs were such a minority that it just wasn't even worth staying. But then I kind of expanded and found that that's not really true. That, so people say like the Catholic Church is a big tent, right? And so you kind of have to find your corner,
finding
of the tent.
Your people. Yeah.
And that's really just made such a difference and strengthened me to be more outspoken. And something that you said when we were chatting earlier is like, when you realize how privileged you are and that you don't actually have much to lose by speaking out. And there are people who would be in danger if they said some of the things that I said, or, you know, or do and are in danger, or could really financially suffer a loss or any of those things. It's like, I think it's not like the stakes are not that high for me. You know, if I don't get a book published by, you know, a Catholic publisher, I'll find another publisher. If I, you know, lose a job, I'll find another job and my family will be okay. The lovely thing is that the company that I work for, National Catholic Reporter, is a progressive, independent newspaper. And so most of the people who work there share my worldview and beliefs. And we do a lot of reporting on marginalized communities and within the Catholic Church, and teachings that could potentially and have been proven to cause harm to people, and whether those things could change. So there's a lot of focus on that in my work. And because it's independent and lay led, there's no risk of me losing my job.
Yeah.
And so that's just been really lovely, because that has not always been true in the past.
Right.
And that has been a scary thing. But yeah, so I think finding circles like NCR, finding the Jesuits, finding the Franciscans, like there, and Catholic workers, there's just so much good, and there's so much work being done in the way that gives me hope, and that gives me, you know, just feels like I can stay. I will say these days I'm actually feeling more support than backlash.
That's wonderful. And honestly, from where I'm sitting, not surprising, because I think that you have to want to find your people, and you have to want to do that work to look for them. But we're out there. I mean, one of the reasons why this show, Faithfully Memphis, has been such a special thing for us in our Episcopal diocesan community here in Memphis is that Memphis is not a place, and Shelby County and the sort of region where we are, this is not a place where people don't know about Christianity. Yeah. Everyone comes with it. It's the buckle of the Bible Belt. I mean, it's not necessarily a religious question to ask somebody, oh, where do you go to church? Because it's just, everyone has some kind of, it seems like everyone has an affiliation, or they were raised with some kind of affiliation.
Yeah.
But there's so, it's difficult sometimes within lots of Christian circles to call out and say, we love you. Mm-hmm. And we're not saying that so that you'll join us.
And like, we can change you.
Yeah. No, we have no interest in changing you. Like the way that you are is how we believe God made you, and we love you for that. And we want to share our walk with you. Mm-hmm. And I think that going on those walks and finding those groups of people, we're out there. And we're also the people who are working hard to stamp out the kind of oppression and privilege that has been used to wield pain for pretty much the moment Christianity picked up any kind of steam 2000 years ago.
Yeah.
We're ready to dethrone that.
Yeah. There's so much good work being done. It's like, it's so inspiring. I feel so small in the best way when I look at like some of the work that other Catholics are doing. Like there's just really lovely stuff happening.
So do you have any prayers in this book that are especially meaningful to you, or something that means a lot to you in particular? I always love asking artists and creators and writers, like, okay, I love all your work, but I want to know what you love of what you created, because everyone's got their favorite little creative baby.
That's a good question. Yeah. Like, so in this book, I mean, obviously it began because I was literally writing prayers for my daughter, Thea. But as I fleshed out what the book needed to be to span a woman's entire life, because it is not just for, you know, the child rearing years, it's actually probably more of the prayers are for women in adulthood or in adulthood. Yeah. And so, you know, it's kind of, obviously I'm thinking about her a lot when I'm writing those as well, thinking about through the future, but there was also just this very real sense of writing with a mother's heart, or maybe the heart of the divine feminine, you know, with like just thinking of my peers and women in college that I know, or, you know, just not necessarily my specific daughter. So one of the things that was really fun was to like imagine these prayers being used by real people. Just like me writing or reading them about my own literal daughter. So there are some, like one of the ones that's my favorite is the prayer for menarche, the first period, first menstruation.
Yeah.
And that was really fun because I feel like as women, we have just not been given anything for that rite of passage.
At least not in our Western tradition.
Exactly.
Your mom kind of skirts around it. Your doctor does. They're going to talk about it in school, but it's.
And it's like, I think in our culture, menstruation has come with so much shame, like the shame of like it happening in public, or just like jokes about, you know, oh, it's your time of the month or whatever. Like, and so I like really love the picture of women choosing to reclaim that and having like ceremonies or rituals or something for our girls where we can speak over them, like that this is a beautiful thing, that this is their reflection of God, who is always, you know, coming alive from the dead, and just the sacredness of blood and how powerful that is. And so that particular prayer, I hope to, when my daughter starts menstruating, if it's something that she wants, then I hope to gather some women around and read this prayer over her and have some sort of ritual similar to, there's a prayer for her 40th birthday. And I really love the idea of like at a birthday party, like her mother reading this prayer to her in front of all of her friends, you know, or like there's like a prayer for women's ordination. And so like, how cool would it be for like a congregation to pray that, you know, in honor of a woman who is being ordained. And I don't know, I think it's obvious that the book can be used for personal and private practice, but I also love that it's special to me to think of it being used in communal ways too.
I definitely identify that because I want to share this book so much. I want to share it with other women who, and other men who, I mean, you don't have to be a woman to be a feminist.
Right.
I want to share it, and I want to pray the prayers with people who I know see that spirit of love and that spirit of creation and just the beauty in the everyday. I feel like you really honor that in this book.
Thank you so much. One thing that has surprised me since it's come out is how many people buy multiple copies for every woman who's close to them. And I guess I just like, that was such a lovely surprise to hear.
And we're gearing up for a graduation season too, so
bring it for graduation gifts. For sure. So that's been wonderful. And to hear from dads, I've heard from dads like, I needed to hear this because it's easy for me to not think about these things that are going to be in my daughter's life, you know. It's like I'm going to be blindsided when this happens. So it was like, to have it all in a book like helps me see what to be praying. And I really appreciated that openness. And I have like this one guy friend, this one Catholic guy who like has just been shouting it from the rooftops, like on his social media. And like, he's gay. He's not a dad. Like he's youngish. Like he has no obvious skin in the game, but he sees the importance of like that this is missing in our religious tradition and that it's needed. And that has meant a lot to me.
Thank you for writing it. Thank you for just being you. This has been, I've loved getting to chat and talk and ask you all these questions. Let me ask you something. This is something that we typically end our conversations with on this show. What is giving you hope? We're recording this during the first week of Easter on our Western calendar. It's Easter Thursday. You know, living in America means that everything between the month that we're recording this and it actually airs, everything could be different.
Anything could happen. Yep.
And I try to focus on all the good things that happen, but sometimes it just really, it's easier to focus on just the chaos and the injustice and the problems and the just blatant sigh-worthy things that happen on a normal day-to-day basis. But I feel like looking in with intentionality to hope and the things that are lifting us up, that's what gets me through the day. Mm-hmm. So what is giving you hope? What is something that you look at and you say, okay, I can keep going.
That's good. I have a lot of different answers, so I'm trying to decide which one to go with. But one thing in the past year and a half that has truly given me a hope that sustains is Catholic sisters. They are just doing incredible work, and most of them in old age. Yeah. And just seeing these women like in their 60s, 70s, even 80s, speaking truth to power about like speaking out against the bishops just recently released a document that was very disheartening about the Catholic, the U.S. bishops, about Catholic stance on medical health care for transgender people. And thousands of nuns like released this statement in support of transgender people. And they're just constantly doing stuff like that. And I just, there's all of these, they're doing so much for climate justice, for climate change. They're using the lands that they have, and their diminishing numbers no longer require these lands. And they're doing incredible environmental work with them. And they, I just, Catholic sisters for life, man.
I love that. Well, I need to educate myself on them.
What you should do is you should subscribe to Global Sisters Report.
Okay.
It's like a project of National Catholic Reporter where I work. And that is where I started learning about all of this work that they were doing.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's awesome. It's news from around the world, but it's amazing.
Cool. And I'll put that link in our show notes too. So if folks want to subscribe and learn about this pocket of beauty that is doing good work and support that work, they can do that. Shannon, how can people learn more about you and read what you're writing and see what you're doing?
Yeah, probably the easiest ways are Instagram and Substack. That's where I hang out the most. And Substack, I try to send out an email once a week. Okay. Some weeks it doesn't happen, but you can find me there. Shannon K. Evans. I write The Rewilded Life. But you could just put my name in there. And then Instagram, it's Shannon K. Evans again. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me for Faithfully Memphis. Thank you so much to WYXR 91.7 FM, our crosstown radio home here in Memphis, Tennessee. You can listen to almost 2.5 years of past episodes of our podcast on Faithfully Memphis. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, Google, and all the regular places. if you feel so inclined, please leave us a positive review. It really helps us spread the word about what it is that we're doing with this show. Hey, we invite you to share our show with someone who may not have heard it. Thank you so much to Shannon K. Evans. Go on our website and get all the good information about her. You can also go on our website, edwtn.org, to learn more about the Episcopal Church in West Tennessee. I am Emily Austin. Until next time, stay safe, stay positive. Bye.